Hi, I'm Karen Given, executive producer of Only a Game. This is a sports show, sort of, so it might not come as a surprise to learn that we here at Only a Game are relatively competitive people. And we're right now in the middle of a competition of sorts, NPR's year-end digital fundraising campaign. Okay, so it's not a sport exactly, but stick with me. We're asking you to pause this podcast right now and go to donate.npr.org/game to make a donation to your local station. By supporting your local station, you'll not only support Only a Game and the other great NPR podcasts you hear, but you'll also support local news, something I think we can all agree is pretty darn important. And if Only a Game listeners raise enough money, we get a trophy. That's right, a trophy. So this is serious, folks. Your local station needs your support, and we need that trophy. Just go to donate.npr.org/game to find your local station and get started. And thanks. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
From 200 yards.
Come in there, right. Baby, come eat. Throw
it. Oh. Pro golfer George Archer hit his second shot on 15 into the drink during the final round of the 1969 Masters.
I thought I hit a real good shot, but it went in the water, and I felt like I was in the water with that ball.
Archer's pro career spanned 5 decades. His wife Donna and their 2 daughters often toured with him. They were a close family. And they needed to be, because George Archer had a secret they all had to keep. Reporter Ken Shulman has more.
It starts like a great American story. The boy from the wrong side of the tracks shows up at the swanky country club to make a few extra bucks as a caddy.
George had a very rough and tumble childhood.
Mike Jameson was a teenager when he first met George Archer in San Mateo, California.
He lived near the Peninsula Club, and his neighbor said, hey, let's go over to the Peninsula Club and earn some money caddying. And George said, what's caddying?
George took to caddying. He liked bringing home the extra cash. On Mondays, when the course at the Peninsula Club was closed to members, he played golf with the other caddies. He took to that as well. But caddy day conflicted with Monday afternoon basketball practice at San Mateo High.
So he chose to go to caddy day at Peninsula Club and play golf. So that's why the 6'6" George Archer played golf instead of basketball.
It was a good choice. When George graduated high school in 1958, he was already one of the best amateurs in the state. And golf helped him meet his wife Donna in 1960. George was playing in an amateur tournament.
So I knew who he was, and I just wanted to go out and watch him play, because he was really tall.
Did you like his game?
Oh, yeah. I liked his game a lot.
Donna and George chatted across the ropes on the 13th fairway. They met up again when he finished the round. He asked her out. The first date went well. The next one's even better. George was sweet and kind and funny. He was a great golfer. Sure, he had his quirks. One night,
we were kind of driving around, a police car came. We got pulled over. Then when we stopped, it was dark, and George said, trade places with me. And so I didn't question it. I just did it because you're kind of scared when you're 17.
Donna asked him about that afterwards.
That's when he told me about the reading, that he didn't have a driver's license.
The reading. George Archer had always struggled in school. Even now at 21, he couldn't read or write well enough to pass the written test.
He wasn't completely unable. He was about 3rd to 4th grade level.
Donna was a bit surprised, but she wasn't at all discouraged.
I wanted to help him and take care of him, and I wanted to help him with his career. He didn't have much help in his own family, so I thought I could save him and teach him how to read. I was 17 years old, so I had a lot of illusions.
About a year after they met, George asked Donna to marry him. At least she thought he had.
We used to walk to my house from the bus station. And as we were walking home, George said to me, "I wonder what our kids will look like." I took that as a proposal, whether he meant it or not.
They married a month later and moved into a modest San Francisco apartment near a public golf course.
Well, the putting green was right across the street from our apartment. A lot of times he would go out and meet his buddies out there, and they would putt with their car lights on. They played for dollars or quarters or something. Every once in a while, he made enough money for us to go out to dinner instead of having spaghetti for dinner every night.
George did well in the amateur circuit and won several tournaments. In 1964, he, Donna, and two-month-old daughter Elizabeth packed up the family car and set out on the pro tour. The couple decided to keep George's reading problems a secret.
He was always ashamed of it, which was really sad because it's not something to be ashamed of.
George won his first pro tournament in 1965. Then he won some more. In January 1969, he won the Bing Crosby Pro-Am at Pebble Beach. The long nights on the putting green were paying off. But the reading and writing work he did with Donna wasn't.
We had a tutor at one time, but he would reach a point where he was so impatient about it, he would say, "I have a mental block," and that it feels like driving a race car into a cement wall. "I can't get through that cement wall."
On the tour, to keep his secret, George Archer had to find a way around that wall.
I don't know if you've seen the massive leaderboard at a PGA golf tournament, but it's huge. And George knew that his name was on the left under the A's, and his friend Larry Ziegler's name was on the right under the Z's.
When he needed money?
He had a prototype check with him, and it had a certain amount of money on it, and he would copy that. And then if he needed more, he would call and we would go through the writing of the check together.
And at restaurants?
George didn't eat that many varieties of foods. He knew what he wanted and he would ask that. Early on in the tour, when you have a family and you have limited funds, we ate a lot in cafeterias. He didn't need to read that menu, did he?
In April 1969, the family pulled into Augusta National in Georgia for the Masters.
George was sick. He got the flu. And so he wasn't even sure by Wednesday that he would be able to play in the Masters.
But he did play and took a 3-stroke lead into the final nine. That lead soon evaporated. Then on 15, George hit a second shot into the pond. He hit a gutsy wedge shot over water, but that still left him with a tough 12-foot putt to save par.
And George told me that there was what he called a little holiday that ran from his ball into the cup.
Again, that's friend Mike Jameson.
I said, "George, what's a holiday?" And he says, "Well, if you could imagine, the greens mower at the time had left this little tiny ridge when they mowed the greens that happened to run from where my ball was into the hole."
George Archer for a par.
So I don't know whether they really missed something or George was so highly focused he saw the line so perfectly. But anyway, he made that putt.
Archer won the 1969 Masters by a single stroke. After the match in the Augusta National Clubhouse, he struggled to stuff his 6'6" frame into the club's fabled green winner's jacket.
I'm amazed they have one my size. Thank you.
And there it was, the caddy from the rough side of town, the self-taught guru of the green, bagging golf's most prestigious prize. It should have brought him greater fame, big sponsorships and endorsements, but it didn't. There was too much risk and embarrassment.
He was working under contract for Bullet Golf, and they were going to film some commercials in Southern California. And he could not sleep a wink that night because there was a script that he had to memorize. So when we finally went out to the golf course to start the filming of the commercials, he just told them, "I'm not going to read this script. I'm going to improvise." And it took 33 takes for him to get through the commercial.
In the fall of 1971, a few days before Mike Jamison left for college, he asked George for a signed photo. George had spent hours with him, helping him with his game. Jamison thought a signed photo from a Masters champion would impress his college golf teammates.
And George said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And I said, "Come on, you're the Masters champion." He said, no. So we argued about it for a while. And finally, when I got to school, he finally sent me a photo. And it said, "Study hard, George Archer." And I thought, "Great Scott, that's the best he can come up with, study hard?"
None of George's friends knew his secret, only his family. Daughter Lynn remembers when she found out.
I think I was in fourth grade. We were laying in the afternoon on the bed in front of the TV, and I had my book for school with me. So I was laying next to my dad, and I gave him the book and said, "Oh, here, Dad, read to me." So I passed him the book, and he started to read and was just stumbling like a kindergartner. And I was so, like, just shocked. And I remember going, "Come on, Dad, quit joking around. Read the book." And he kept trying, and he just said, "I can't."
As she grew older, she saw how much her father dreaded signing autographs.
I could feel his spine straighten up or the hairs on his back like a cat stand up. That was kind of an underlying current throughout the growing up years. Like, when is that scary thing going to happen? When will someone be embarrassed? You know, how can we avoid the shame, the secret? When you have a secret that you're really embarrassed about, it takes a lot of courage to be such a public person.
George played pro golf for nearly 50 years, notching 43 PGA and senior wins. He won his last senior tournament in 2000.
George was ill for about a year, and toward the end, I asked him about considering revealing his learning difficulty, if we might be able to do some good with that revelation. He was a bit reluctant, but then he said, "If you think you can do some good, then go ahead and talk about it after I'm gone."
In 2005, a few days shy of his 66th birthday, George Archer died of lymphoma. 6 months later, Donna wrote a magazine article to share what she and her daughters had long known. George Archer was dyslexic, undiagnosed, and untreated. He'd repeated second grade 3 times. His teachers finally moved him into the 5th grade only because he was so tall. Donna's magazine article stunned many of George's closest friends, including Mike Jamison.
Because I had known George from 1969 until the day he died. I had played golf with him. I had practiced with him. I'd caddied for him.
Looking back, Jamison saw he'd missed so many signs. At breakfast, when friends offered George the sports section, he'd say, "No thanks, just tell me if the Giants won." And that photo George sent him his freshman year in college, signed, "Study hard, George Archer."
George didn't write that. Donna wrote that.
He understands why George kept the dyslexia to himself. Imagine if the secret had come out during a tournament back in the 60s or 70s.
There were some players who were pretty hard-nosed players and would have used any trick in the book to try and get inside of George's head or anybody's head if they could. Like saying, "Hey, George, how you gonna read this putt?"
Jamison even thinks George's learning disability might have helped him focus on the greens, like that holiday George saw on 15 at the 1969 Masters.
Because sometimes people with learning disabilities, especially reading disabilities, do visualize things. And in putting, if you can visualize the ball going into the hole, you have achieved 90% of the goal of good putting. And he was able to do that.
A week or so after Donna's article appeared, she met Jamison for lunch.
And I said, "Well, Donna, what are you going to do the rest of your life?" And she said, "Michael, I don't know." And I said, "Well, you need to start a foundation. We need to raise money for literacy." And for me, it's always been like a Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney kind of moment, like, "Hey, kids, let's put on a show. We'll have a tournament right here. We'll do it right at Peninsula Club, where George was an honorary member, where George started out as a caddy, and we'll raise money for literacy. Let's do it."
Daughter Lynn is a special education teacher. She says her father's life might have gone differently if he were growing up today.
He would have been identified as being dyslexic. He would have had intervention that's very specific. I'm working with a student now who probably is just a reincarnation of my dad, you know, the grasping for the letters, the trying to get the P and the B straight. And it makes me feel connected to him, in fact.
Donna Archer launched the George Archer Memorial Foundation in 2007. Apart from their family and his 1969 Masters win, it's her husband's greatest legacy. We know that people with dyslexia often perceive language and stories through pictures. But some people, like George Archer, also paint pictures with their lives. Pictures painted with perfect strokes. Strokes of bravery, says Donna Archer, and compassion.
The arc of his life is his courage and his persistence. And so that's a major lesson, that every person you look at probably has a secret or a goal or a talent or something that the world doesn't see. So it's important to know that about people and be kind.
That story came from reporter Ken Shulman. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
NPR's Life Kit wants to help you make changes that actually stick this new year. From how to do dry January to how to start a creative habit. We've got new episodes all month to help you start the year off right. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
Never thought I'd ask you this question. Is the coin flip reviewable?
The coin flip actually is not reviewable, but I think we need to revisit
Bad NFL officiating has perhaps reached a new level, and that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Hannah Kaiser of Yahoo Sports and by ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. via Skype. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Hi again, Karen.
Okay, Don, you are up first.
Well, you know, we're only a couple weeks away now from the start of the NFL playoffs. I'll be hanging on every yellow flag and non-flag to see if the league's referees make another colossal mistake and decide yet again who gets to play in the Super Bowl. Of course, I'm referring to last January's NFC Championship game. The ref's non-call of that obvious pass interference by the LA Rams helped deny the New Orleans Saints a ticket to last year's Super Bowl. The NFL this season let coaches challenge pass interference calls and non-calls. Unfortunately, all the NFL did was take a broken system and put even more error-prone humans in charge of it. And it's been really a terrible season for NFL officials. And it got so bad for last Sunday's Rams-Cowboys game that a ref botched the coin toss. At halftime, the league office had to step in and fix it. But I have a wild theory that I want to run by you guys.
Okay.
The NFL isn't really all that troubled by all this controversy. All of that stuff just turbocharges fans' conversations and adds even more drama to the game, helping boost the ratings. So I'm wondering, is the NFL truly motivated to try to fix this problem, or are they even capable of fixing it?
I am completely compelled by this argument. You tapped immediately into something that is sort of existentially facing baseball, which is the only sport I can speak intelligently about. Sorry, football. Because of the whole robot umps. And the idea of robot umps is fascinating to people. This will deprive us of a common enemy. That officiants are the only true bad guys in sports. And you can't get mad at a robot. That will be no fun.
I mean, it's so true. Bad officiating is such a constant. I sometimes wonder why we get so worked up about it. But the idea that the league has no interest in getting it right because getting it wrong somehow benefits the product, this is totally a conspiracy theory that I can get behind. I am not imagining, though, Don, a boardroom of executives sitting around debating the cost-benefit analysis of better officiating. I think it's probably just that if something isn't affecting the bottom line, there's really no reason to fix it. But Don, am I wrong? Is perfect officiating even a possibility in this world?
No, it's completely impossible. And you raise a really good question about the cost effectiveness of this. Ratings have skyrocketed this year. That's the metric I think that they're more focused on. You know, Rich McKay is the Falcons president. He's the head of the NFL competition committee. And at the owners meeting earlier this month, he said about these bad calls, there's no question there has been angst. Angst was the word he used. Angst is a kind of polite term for how fans are feeling about this.
On the other hand, there's like an entire TV network built around angst. It's called the CW, and it's very popular.
That's right. Yes.
We need star-crossed referee lovers, a new CW show.
Coming this fall. All right, Hannah, you're up.
All right, so MLB batters hit 6,776 home runs last season, which doesn't mean much, but it is 671 more than the previous record in 2017, and more than 1,000 more, 1,000 more home runs than in any other year before 2017. The past three seasons have been dominated by home runs. It has fundamentally changed the kind of baseball that we are watching. And people started to think that this is because of the baseball, that maybe Major League Baseball was juicing it on purpose because of how much people love home runs. Of course, chicks dig the long ball. There had been a study done on the 2017 ball, and there was a new study done this year that was recently released. And what they found was, all right, this is where we get into the numbers. 60% of the increase in home runs is, in fact, a result of a decrease in drag. Balls are smoother, they're flying faster, basically they're rounder than ever. And 40% is a result of batter behavior. And probably that's a feedback loop. Balls that fly further make you more likely to want to hit balls up and out of the ballpark. And of that 60% that is a result of the decrease in drag, 35%, sorry, percents of percents, is a result of seam height. How much has the seam height changed? 0.001 inches, or the size of a human hair.
One of the things, Hannah, that I'm so confused about with all those numbers is why. They say what has changed with the balls, and they're very small percentages, but they don't explain why they have possibly changed, or do they? Or am I missing something?
They do not.
Okay, so this thing that they're pointing at, this seam height thing, is still a percentage of a percentage. And then it absolutely does not explain why home runs suddenly decreased this postseason. And I feel a little bit like I am being played by the Wizard of Oz right now. Like, hey, look at this shiny seam height thing and don't notice everything else that's going on behind the curtain.
Particularly when you look at the fact that included in this report was some information about how the amount that the average changes year to year is actually significantly less than the amount that individual balls differ from each other. And that should make baseball players very mad, I think. Because if balls are different within games, that will actually affect who wins.
Also, I think this might be the geekiest this show has ever gotten. So thank you for that.
I'm honored. Happy to be here.
And you know what? I got to say, I don't have a lot of confidence in these team of physics professors and people who are far smarter than any three of us when they got it wrong in 2017. And now we're supposed to have confidence in this 2019 report. What are we going to hear in 2021?
I trust that they know when they say they don't know.
Yeah.
But what I don't know is whether or not what they don't know, they should know.
Yes. Well said.
Very well said. All right. Bronny James is a freshman at Sierra Canyon High School in West Los Angeles. He's also the 15-year-old son of LeBron James. Last weekend, Bronny and Sierra Canyon faced LeBron's alma mater, St. Vincent St. Mary of Akron, Ohio. The game was played in the 20,000-seat home arena of the Columbus Blue Jackets with more than 400 credentialed members of the media in attendance. Bronny isn't even the best player on his team. Sierra Canyon has two seniors who are five-star recruits, and also Zaire, son of Dwayne Wade, and a player from China who is 7'3". And on the one hand, we can congratulate LeBron James and his wife Savannah for trying to insert some sanity into this kid's life. They deliberately chose a school with a whole lot of celebrity comings and goings, a school that prepares its student body to handle things like social media, and that's good. On the other hand, travel tournaments from Las Vegas to Virginia are selling tickets based on the fact that the son of LeBron James is coming to town. ESPN will be broadcasting 10 more Sierra Canyon games this season. And at last check, Bronny had 3.9 million Instagram followers, and that number is increasing so quickly, I'm pretty sure he will have hit 4 million before this conversation even makes it to air. Hannah, what do you make of all this?
I thought what was interesting about the school was, right, this idea that they're teaching kids how to manage their social media, and that seems smart for people who are 15 and already know that they're going to be in the public eye probably the rest of their life. Spare a thought for the reporters, however. One of the things that I found almost troubling was this idea that the school decided that he should not do any interviews this year. However, they are making a documentary about him. It just happens to be LeBron James's production company, and he's sort of controlling the shots. And it's understandable that we would want to protect a child and even a teenager, but I am concerned that we're creating a generation of superstars who are only accessible through their very own carefully controlled, intentionally favorable media. But I think that if you're going to be that famous, you should also learn how to face media that isn't controlled by your dad.
Good point. Don?
Yeah, I love that point, Hannah. And I was also struck by the fact that LeBron's uninterrupted media platform is the one that's doing one of the two documentaries in production about the Sierra Canyon team and its players. And so there is an insulation to Bronny that is intriguing. And of course, that LeBron, in fact, created. You can, you know, trace it back to the decision nearly 10 years ago on ESPN when LeBron cut out the media when he announced that he was taking his talents to South Beach. So that's very intriguing. I have to say, though, that I am, you know, so touched by LeBron and Savannah and what they're attempting to do here for Bronny. As you pointed out, Karen, there's going to be 10 of these games on ESPN, and they're selling out these arenas across the country. And I was really struck, too, by the photograph that went viral over the weekend of LeBron and Savannah. They had front row seats. Bronny's shot was in midair, and just the look of anticipation on LeBron's face and Savannah's face as that shot went up and went in was such a great visual of parents being there for their son. And LeBron has taught so many wonderful lessons in his career, and that's another one that he taught again over this weekend.
Yeah, yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that other documentary that's being made this year is by Dwayne Wade's production company. So talk about,
right.
Right. Yes. So talk about having very friendly media. But, you know, for a 15-year-old, maybe very friendly media is appropriate.
Yeah.
At some point, he is going to have to go out in the big, wide, bad world.
But maybe he won't. He'll just talk directly to his 3.9 million Instagram followers.
Oh, it's got to be 4 million by now.
4 million. Sorry, Bronny. Didn't mean to undersell you. I appreciated the ways in which their version of normalcy is surrounding him with other abnormal kids. Children of celebrities are going to be celebrities, and the best thing that their parents can sort of do for them, and you're right, Don, that this is like a lovely act of parental oversight,
yeah,
is an attempt to figure out a specific childhood that takes that into account and doesn't ignore it.
Yeah. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Hannah Kaiser of Yahoo Sports and ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Karen.
Should you be feeling generous this holiday season, please do us a solid and subscribe to the Only a Game podcast. And if you're feeling extra generous, please leave us a review. It will help more people find our show. And happy holidays from all of us here at Only a Game.
My friends, the decade is drawing to a close, and with it, as always, comes that predictable avalanche of best of lists, you know, best of music, best of movies, you know, the tallies of all the highlights and ephemera of the past 10 years.
That's the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay.
In sports, there's plenty to remember. It was a decade, of course, that witnessed LeBron James taking his talents from Cleveland to Miami and then going back to Cleveland and then finally finishing up out in Los Angeles. This was also the decade of Serena Williams, of Simone Biles, of Usain Bolt, Johnny Football, James Harden, and Elena Delladun. We saw the rise and, more recently, the total collapse of the great Golden State Warriors, and we saw two World Cup victories for the U.S. women's national soccer team. And you know what? If nothing else, this was a decade in which we saw the Chicago Cubs win the World Series, a supernatural event which I am still not sure actually happened. These are great memories, great athletes, all of them. But as we close the ledger on the 2010s, I want to remember another athlete who may not be on most people's lists, but very much deserves to be there. I'm talking, of course, about the Monday Night Football Cat.
There is a black cat now on the field.
Oh, yeah. We cannot forget the Monday Night Football Cat. That's the cat which made a spectacular appearance in November of this year at a Giants-Cowboys football game in New Jersey. It was this tense divisional contest, national TV, the whole thing. And Monday Night Football Cat strides confidently out onto the field. Just, you know, stopping out there with this delightfully preening cat swagger. Before charging more than 50 yards downfield into the end zone. That's right. This kitty went from the 50 to the 40 to the 30 to the 20 to the 10 to the 5.
That is a touchdown!
A touchdown for the Monday Night Football Cat. Now, the cat managed to escape stadium security and remains in hiding. It's said to be a stray, feral to the Meadowlands, and is fed by kind strangers. So far, the Monday Night Football Cat has done no interviews, not even with Cat Fancy. There hasn't been a Nike commercial or even one for Friskies. Now, you might think that this was nothing more than a cat running on a field, but that's wrong. I think in that moment, the Monday Night Football Cat reminded us of why we love to watch sports. And that's for those unscripted moments of spontaneous joy. Like the night, at decade's close, when an unknowing stray cat unexpectedly and truly was the most entertaining athlete on Earth.
That's Jason Gay. He's a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Only a Game is produced in Boston with help from listeners like you. Why not make a donation today? Just go to donate.npr.org/game to donate to your local station. And thanks. I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, teammates from Celtics great Bob Cousy to Atlanta Dream head coach Nicky Collin to two high school lacrosse teammates who just can't seem to get along. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
The New Orleans Pelicans are really, really bad. In fact, this week they set a franchise record for badness, 13 straight losses. What's going on?
They lost their best player to the Los Angeles Lakers, and the person that was supposed to replace him hasn't been healthy yet. So those two things combined lead to a very bad opening part of the season.
Well, the good news on Zion Williamson is that he's finally fully weight-bearing on that surgically repaired right meniscus. Is it just me, or is fully weight-bearing a long, long way from ready to change everything in the NBA?
Well, first of all, it makes him sound like an I-beam. Zion's in place. Now we're going to build a family room. Second of all, it does sound, you know, rather ominous for the Pelicans and their fans. I mean, I'm glad that, you know, he is now fully weight bearing, but that has absolutely, you know, that is the most basic thing you can say about somebody who's expected to run up and down the NBA.
Yeah. On the other hand, the LA Lakers are pretty darn good. LeBron James is playing like an MVP candidate. Anthony Davis is scoring 27 points per game. Even Dwight Howard is making a difference. Does this mean we have to stop making fun of the Lakers? Because that was really fun.
Well, you're going to have to find another reason to do it. You know, perhaps the, you know, the glitterati of their fans or you know, the extravagance of their building or something, because you certainly can't make fun of them in basketball court anymore. They are turning into everything people feared they would be. The three players you named are extraordinary talents.
Yeah.
And Dwight Howard is somebody who never quite lived up to things, but he's still a very good basketball player.
NBA ratings are down by a lot. 2 months into the season, we've seen a 17% dip on TNT and ESPN. So I've got a little quiz for you. Are you ready?
Sure.
NBA ratings are down because A, star players have been injured for nationally broadcast games. B, the Golden State Warriors are terrible, leaving the league without a clear-cut favorite. Or C, more people are cutting the cord, especially younger people, and the NBA's fan base skews young.
All three are interesting phenomena. I would guess some combination of the three, but I would think that the most radical reason would be number three.
Yeah.
That is something I can testify to.
Yeah, the cord-cutting thing is absolutely the most interesting to me because the NBA is really good at pushing out content on other platforms, but TV is still where the money is, and if the ratings go down, so will those TV contracts, right?
Absolutely, and I'm going to forgive you for saying pushing out content on other platforms. Because it is the holiday season.
I appreciate that. Thank you. A woman has beaten a man at the World Darts Championship for the very first time. Just to clarify, this does not mean there's a female champion. No, Fallon Sherrock, 25, merely won one match to move on to the second round. And while some people seem very surprised that a woman won, I'm left wondering why it took so long.
So am I. I mean, I don't understand this one. I mean, I would expect that, you know, several would have won entire tournaments by now.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine unless, you know, folks aren't just going to bars anymore.
Maybe women have better things to do with their time than throw little things at a board.
Well, I don't know that that's fair. I mean, darts is, you know, sort of a international institution, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And finally, Charlie, it started on December 10th in Portland when the New York Knicks were in town as the Trailblazers were holding Star Wars night. Then the Knicks went to San Francisco where the Warriors were handing out Kevin Looney Stormtrooper bobbleheads. Then to Sacramento where the Kings held Baby Yoda races. If you haven't seen that video, you really should. And finally to Denver where it was, you guessed it, Star Wars night. What's going on?
Star Wars, perhaps?
a movie?
Yeah, this is an authentically frightening story. The New York Knicks went on the road and could not get away from the promotions for a single film.
Oh, dear.
I mean, this is enough to rip the ears off a Gundark. Seriously.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor for the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
Richard Asquith is a journalist with a story to tell. He's pretty sure you've never heard it before. It's about Czech athlete Lata Brandisová.
Her story's been erased from history, and I think her story deserves to be restored to public knowledge.
Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Countess Maria Immaculata Brandisová was born in 1895 to an aristocratic family in what was then the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Richard Asquith says the countess, known to family and friends as Lata, discovered her calling at a young age.
Her father kept horses and trained horses, and he realized when she was 6 or 7 that she just had this gift. She could communicate with horses. They loved her. She loved them. She was brave. She was tough. She was athletic.
In other words, Lata had all the qualities to be a competitive steeplechase rider in a place and time when steeplechase was the most closely watched sport. The only problem was that steeplechase races were sanctioned by the Prague Jockey Club, which didn't allow women to compete. but the empire collapsed at the end of World War I. Lotta, now in her early 20s, became a citizen of the newly formed Czechoslovakia,
which is a sort of beacon of Western democratic values in the heart of Central Europe.
The Czech constitution guaranteed certain rights for women, but instead of waiting for horse racing to welcome women, Lotta jumped on her bike and made regular 12-mile trips from her home near Prague to Velká Hukla Racecourse. There, she talked with trainers in the hope she'd get a chance to work with them.
And there was one particularly good trainer who realized that she did have this amazing way with horses and let her have a go.
Lotta began exercising horses. Soon she was competing in harness races, but she wanted more than anything to compete in steeplechase, and especially in the Grand Pardubice, Czechoslovakia's most prestigious sporting event.
Which is this extraordinarily dangerous, arduous, demanding steeplechase set up by the aristocracy in the 1870s as a test for cavalry soldiers.
Soldiers from Czechoslovakia, France, Austria, and Germany would compete.
It's a big, long course. It's 4 and a bit miles. It winds in all sorts of zigzags. You know, if you're tough enough to ride this race, you're tough enough to go to war. But, of course, it was absolutely out of the question then. It was very traditional, very old-fashioned society for a woman to do anything like that.
But in the spring of 1927, the Prague Jockey Club had a new president, a man who knew about Lotta's abilities. He helped her acquire a jockey's license and urged her to enter that year's Grand Pardubice.
It caused an absolute scandal because all the people she was riding against were cavalry officers.
Richard Asquith says Lotta believed all 12 male riders protested her entry behind closed doors.
And when she was given the go-ahead, they were still protesting on the day of the race itself, but they couldn't stop her and she did it.
Eight of the military riders failed to finish the 1927 Grand Pardubice. Lotta came in fifth out of the five finishers. Some newspaper accounts called the race a circus, but Lotta proved that she belonged. In 1933, Lotta rode a golden mare named Norma in the Grand Pardubice. They came in fourth. The next year, they came in third. The year after that, they were second. But the stakes were changing. Tensions between Germany and Czechoslovakia, already high, were building. Czechs feared a German invasion to take the Sudetenland, home of many ethnic Germans. Meanwhile, Nazi SS riders had won 7 of the previous 9 Grand Pardubice races.
They were the first German units to actually carry out orders to massacre women and children. I mean, this SS cavalry was a very nasty organization. And the Nazis gloried in their sporting successes. And they saw that as proof that they were a better nation and ultimately that they should take over Czechoslovakia.
For the 1937 race, Germany entered 6 officers, including 3 previous Grand Pardubice winners, among them Oskar Langnick.
And they came to Pardubice to demonstrate their superiority over these people who they literally called the subhuman Slavs. So the Czechoslovaks, conversely, if they could win their race, that was a way of proving that they were a proper nation and weren't to be crushed and that their democracy was worth something as well. The official race day programme talked about the Battle of Pardubice. I mean, it was really, the whole thing was seen almost as a military confrontation.
7 Czech riders entered the race, including Lotta Brandisova. By now, nobody was worried about her gender. What the Czechs needed was a national hero. On October 17, 1937, a crowd of more than 40,000 packed the Pardubice racing grounds.
The starter shouts go, the string is pulled away, and off they go.
13 riders broke from the starting gate. All of them cleared the first 3 relatively straightforward obstacles. But then came the treacherous Taxis Ditch. Taxis requires a blind jump over a 5-foot hedge and over, hopefully not into, a 6-foot ditch. To date, more than 30 horses have died there.
Oskar Langnick, winner of the previous 2 years, falls really badly, breaks his collarbone. Langnick remounts because, you know, you had to remount to show you're a real man, even though he must be in very, very severe pain.
Lotta and Norma cleared Taxis, narrowly avoiding 2 other fallen riders. Lotta's strategy was to take her time, keep out of trouble, and wait for an opening late in the race.
he knows that Norma, her little mare, is a very good jumper, almost infallible jumper. They'll go over reasonably well for 10 or 11 jumps, and then they go off behind the stands across a big area of ploughed fields. This is actually a very testing bit because it can be very heavy mud.
The mud was sometimes so deep and heavy that even the best horses would get worn out in it, making the remaining jumps especially risky. But Lotta had a plan.
She went out slightly wider than the others, where the going wasn't quite so heavy, lost a bit of ground. They come up to this thing called the Snake Ditch, which is one of several very treacherous water jumps. Five horses fell there.
But not Norma. By now, Oscar Langnick, the SS officer with the broken collarbone, was back in the race, vying for the lead with Lotta and German rider Willibald Schlagbaum.
They go off to this bit where they go behind the woods.
There, the riders were temporarily out of sight of spectators and race officials.
All sorts of dirty tricks went on. And according to the latter, Schlagbaum was spending a lot of time trying to sort of cut her out and push her against the wall. But she just stayed calm.
When they emerged from the woods, spectators in the stand saw Schlagbaum in the lead, with Lotta close behind. Langnick, a distant third, still had a shot. With only one obstacle to go, it looked as if the race would once again go to Germany.
But you know, Norma and Lotta had such a great relationship, and Norma loved Lotta so much, and Lotta loved Norma so much. They just worked so well together.
Lotta had gone easy on Norma early in the race. But now she demanded a full sprint. As they approached the final jump,
the neck and neck, Lotta just finds a gap in time, jumps on the inside.
When Lotta and Schlagbaum cleared that last obstacle, Norma had taken the lead. Schlagbaum's horse began to tire, but Norma had plenty in reserve.
She eventually won by 7 lengths.
Thousands of joyous Czechs stormed the track. Langnick offered words of congratulation to Lotta at the finish line. He collapsed and was rushed to a Czech hospital. Afterward, Lotta told the press,
I just had this wonderful feeling that there was no one there who didn't like me. The odds were stacked against her, and she did it through a combination of talent and sheer courage. So she was an icon for her gender, and she was an icon for her nation. And it would have been seen as a humiliation for these Superman, Teutonic Knight riders who are meant to be invincible warriors, and they've been defeated by a subhuman Slav, but they've been defeated by a woman. I mean, yeah, that was a real slap in the face. It was reported in the week following the race that anti-Czech rhetoric used in the Reichstag was the most violent used since 1918.
Less than a year after Lada's big win, the Nazis annexed Czechoslovakia's Sudetenland. Early in 1939, Germany invaded the whole of Czechoslovakia. Soon, the world was at war.
And that's the immediate reason why Lotta Brandisová's story was totally forgotten. And when the Nazis occupied the whole of Czechoslovakia, they then took various aristocratic estates into administration. And one of the very first estates that they confiscated was Lotta Brandisová's. She was not a popular figure with the Nazis, let's put it that way.
In the years that followed, Lotta risked her life to support the Czech resistance. She provided food for resistance fighters and tended to the wounded during the liberation of Prague. As for Lotta's beloved jumper,
Norma avoided being conscripted, but no one in Czech racing knows ultimately what happened to her. There's no record of her death.
Lotta raced a bit after the war. In 1947, she rode in but failed to finish her final Grand Pardubice. After the Soviet invasion of 1948, Lotta and her sisters moved to a little hut in the woods where they lived in relative poverty for more than 30 years. Lotta Brandisová died in 1981. Her story almost died with her. She's still the only woman ever to win the Grand Pardubice. If you ever find yourself at the Pardubice race course, about 75 miles to the east of Prague, look for the stone on which the names of all Grand Pardubice winners are engraved. In the column for 1937, just to the right of the word Norma, it says L. Brandisová. Many who read that don't realize they're looking at the name of a woman.
Lotta Brandisová just seems to have got a particularly raw deal. She was one of that tiny minority of sporting heroes who did what people said was impossible. And it seems ridiculous that one of the highest achieving female athletes of the 20th century should be forgotten.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Richard Asquith is the author of Unbreakable, The Woman Who Defied the Nazis in the World's Most Dangerous Horse Race. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.